Welcome to Claret and Conversation. My name is Katie Asbester, and our guest today is Phil Wolf, who is a writer, actor, and screen actor coach. Now, Phil, you've been rather famously known as an actor. You've said you've filled more than you've achieved, but when you have achieved, you won awards for it. And this is, I asked you what this meant in an effort to write this promo, and you... And I gave up trying to write it down. So perhaps you can do us a favor and explain what you mean by this.
Yes. Okay. I'll try and explain. So as an actor, I started out as an actor. I did an English degree at university, and then I went on to do an advanced diploma at the Central School of Speech and Drama. I started working with a theatre writer, as he was then, Rob Shearman, at Exeter University back in the early 90s. And he's now better known as a Doctor Who writer and a very highly acclaimed short story writer. But he was writing plays at the time, went on to work with Alan Ayckbourn. It's by association, I think, is what I'm really saying here, Katie. Clearly, I can call myself a success, living my life vicariously through people who have more talent than I do. But working with Rob as a playwright was fantastic. We won Sunday Times Awards, that kind of thing.
Well, congratulations. And
thank you. It was a great time. And yes.
But what do you mean you failed more than you achieved? When you achieved, you won awards. What do you mean by that?
As an actor and somebody who's very passionate about acting, but especially film acting, that's what really got me into acting in the first place. Growing up watching, Dustin Hoffman, Jack Nicholson, Chinatown, Marathon Man, all of these films that I watched on my little black and white TV as a kid in my bedroom. And I wanted some of that. I wanted to find out what it was that they were doing. And up to a point, I felt that I was succeeding and more in theater, in actual fact, than film. But as time went on, as the years went by, the decades passed, I began to realize that I wasn't quite as brilliant as I thought I was. But I still had the passion and I still had the interest. And so I think with a lot of actors, you learn a lot. You learn a lot through failing, and that's a key part of it. I didn't realize that at the time. I was just kind of very down on myself and beating myself up on a regular basis. But that's what got me into coaching and screen acting coaching accidentally as much as anything.
Oh, okay. But we're playing footy with this whole issue of failing. What's your definition of failing at acting? You know, I'm talking to somebody who's won awards here. So how do you fail? And how do you know you failed? Let's put it that way. How do you know you failed? It's obvious when you've not failed because you win an award. Okay. So when you failed, how do you know?
I think it depends how big your ego is. So as to whether or not you admit at some point, you look back and you suddenly go, you know what? I don't think I was quite as good as I thought I was.
So you're talking about hard self-analysis of your past performances. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I call it more self-realization. I think it's realizing, you know, after a while you ask the question, well, you know, I'm not as successful an actor as I thought I would be, and yet I've still got a passion, I'm still interested. And rather than blame other people for it, which is what actors are pretty good at doing, whether it's the agent or the casting director or the audience or their parents, anybody other than themselves, the truth of it is it's like any art form, and I think a lot of actors feel as if they've just got an innate talent and that's going to keep them going. And I think I was probably under that illusion to some degree. But over time, I reassessed, and yet by that point, I'd fallen backwards into teaching, and that was an opportunity to figure out things that I hadn't figured out as an actor, in truth.
So it sounds to me like you're quite analytical, actually. It sounds like a more...
Hugely analytical.
Yeah, so, and that helps you teach because you've looked at great performances. I'm just guessing here, Phil, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're onto something, definitely.
You look very analytically, like what makes this a great performance? Mm. You know, how could somebody have improved his performance in this particular movie? And then you've tried to share that with students.
You're right. That's a really good point. And in actual fact, there's no correlation. Well, there isn't a direct correlation with analyzing something successfully and putting it into practice. Perhaps that's a really obvious thing to say. With acting, and this isn't something that occurred to me, there's a giant titanium, adamantium, vibranium, a very strong wall is what I'm trying to say here.
I've seen X-Men. I know what
you know what I'm talking about. So we're talking about a very, very strong metal indeed. There's a wall that comes down between the practice side of something, but certainly acting, and the analysis, the preparation side. And I hadn't quite cottoned onto that. So you're absolutely right. It's great to do preparation, which is essentially analysis or technique, learning technique, the headbound stuff that might supercharge the other bits and pieces that make an art form of interest, certainly when it comes to acting. And the other bit, however, shouldn't and mustn't involve any of that headbound stuff, by which I mean as soon as you walk from the wings onto a stage, you certainly shouldn't be mentally thinking things through, objectives, intentions. Anything that you've done in your preparation at that point is completely redundant, because you've got to be in the moment with the other actor in order to make it a live, spontaneous thing. And the same is true for acting on the screen. I hadn't made that distinction, I think, would be fair to say. But you're right. If you've worked, as I did, overly hard at the preparation side of it, which is the mental activity, then it puts you in a good place, I think, to be, hopefully, a screen acting coach, in my case, who can advise and direct. It's essentially directing, with some information, and perhaps give actors who are less headbound than you are an opportunity to excel and bring a piece to life.
Wonderful. So it sounds a bit like it's necessary but insufficient. So you have to do the prep work, but that doesn't necessarily mean your performance is going to be, even if you do great prep work, doesn't mean that your performance is going to be great.
No, it's completely counterintuitive, the whole process. And it maybe it's true of every art form. I don't know anything about football, but so people tell me, if you're a great footballer, you spend most of your life kicking a ball into a net. And then, day after day. And then when you find yourself on the pitch, you're not thinking of who you're going to be passing the ball to. It happens.
Yeah.
And
yeah. I do think that's true in many fields, Phil. So one of the things I always encourage my authors to do for Claret Press is to read more in their chosen genre. Because one of the things that is, I find it somewhat staggering, you know, someone goes on a wonderful trip around Cambodia or Thailand or Vietnam and says, oh, you know, I've got a travelogue. I'm going to publish my travelogue of my journey. It's like, have you read any travelogues? Like, is this something that you read a lot of?
Yeah.
And having to persuade them that this is something that they have to just consume until it becomes muscle memory before they can start writing it.
That's exactly right. I understand the reticence, having said that, because a lot of people think, and I did, that the more you examine something, almost the more you're going to kill whatever it is that you thought you were good at or were good at in the first place. But it's not repeatable, because as you rightly say, you've got to know the structure, you've got to understand what everybody else has done. It just depends on how you look at it. If you're then copying it slavishly, then no, you're going to become a hack, I think, in whatever line of work that you find yourself in. But if you look at it the right way, then you're learning and stealing from the best, as Francis Ford Coppola once said, and then you're allowing that information to filter itself through your own voice in whatever way it is that you express it.
Yeah, this is always the tricky thing about creativity.
Yeah.
Is, you know, what is it? And it's very difficult to say, well, what it is being that analysis that we were talking about of other great works, whether it's an acting performance or a novel. And then making it your own somehow. Somehow there's some magic ingredient that's added into the mix. So it's a mixture of both. You know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and then we add a little bit of ourselves, didn't we?
It is. Well, I think it's everything of ourselves. And I think that's what makes a great artist authentic and exciting and interesting, if somehow they've brought themselves entirely to what it is that they do. The oddness of it is, or so it seems to me now, is that doesn't exclude everybody else's experience. Quite the opposite.
What do you mean? You've lost me. I'm sorry, Phil.
It isn't the case that I think a lot of actors feel that they're already there. They're already ready to go, and they don't need any training. Or in fact, training is going to kill the spontaneity that they've already got. and they're kind of half right, but also very importantly half wrong. You need both, and maybe this perhaps is true of any art form, which is that you need to have an individual voice. You need to embrace your idiosyncrasies, my vulnerabilities, what makes me interesting, and be absolutely cast iron confident about that. But at the same time, you need a way of putting that across. And there you can learn from everybody else. I mean, clearly that's the case with any painters you'd care to throw a brush at.
Mm-hmm.
They,
mm-hmm.
you know, no coincidence do they spend their lives slavishly working over and over and over again on whatever it
copying the masters.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, nonetheless, what makes them a great artist is they're doing something we've never seen before, ever.
Yeah.
And that is because they're doing it from themselves, you know, relentlessly.
So, Phil, you then took all this this understanding, this awkward, the square in the circle, this very uncomfortable compromise of being both spontaneous and highly analytical,
mm-hmm.
both, you know, in the moment and also exceptionally well prepared.
Mm.
And you've turned this into the Screen Actors coaching.
Screen Actors London, which is the company.
Screen Actors London.
Absolutely, yes. I've started off with my partners, Tom and Leonie. And
you're teaching courses, are you?
We are teaching courses over at Mount View Drama Academy, which is a lovely new building in Peckham. Very well equipped for what we're doing. So we're in a TV and film studio. So we have all of the facilities we'd need. And I work very particularly with the two-camera setup, which involves a camera switcher, which, to cut a long story short, means that we can live edit, and that means we can playback scenes almost in a sort of a rough assembly version, as you would see in a film or a TV series. But training-wise.
Fantastic. Mm. Is it going well?
It's going extremely well. We're always looking to get more people involved. As with any small business, we're looking to, you know, keep afloat, but we're very proud of what we've been able to achieve. And what we are looking to do is working with professional actors with the same passions that we've got for screen acting. They don't have to be screen actors per se, but they have to have an interest and a passion for it. Well, and that's
what is the difference between screen acting and theatre acting? Like
that's the big question.
Yeah.
And that's usually where we find ourselves starting, and a lot of people who work in screen acting coaching start, because you have a lot of people who are familiar working in theatre and then are trying to find a way of appropriating what they do in theatre to the camera. In terms of preparation, you need a good process whether you're a theatre actor or a screen actor. So there aren't necessarily too many differences in that respect. But technically, and with regard to the medium itself, there are big differences. In respect of the fact that you haven't got an audience, putting it very simply. And that's a small thing to say, but a very big thing to take on properly as an actor, especially if you're trained in terms of your physical approach to acting, and your awareness of the audience is key to it, whereas as a screen actor, that's not going to do you any good at all, because there is no audience. And so what the camera's interested in is absolutely authentic behavior that is voyeuristic, is fly on the wall, and
so how
draws
you
in.
How you behave if no one was watching.
Exactly that,
yeah.
Spot on,
yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
They say that who you really are is the way you act when no one's watching.
Which is why the quality of vulnerability that is required of a screen actor is fundamental to what we do. It should be on stage as well, in truth. But I think, I feel that theatre actors like to think that they can get away with a lot more on stage, because...
But they can play to the audience.
They can play to the audience, and they can, you know, throw a little artifice in, something that isn't quite real, quite immediate, quite in the moment.
Theatrical. But we have a whole word for it, you know?
It's theatrical, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. She's theatrical. Yeah.
But
she's a drama queen.
Which is most definitely a pejorative phrase or a pejorative word to...
Well, it means false.
It means false.
Yeah.
And the great theatre that I've seen, and the odd occasion that I've seen it, it stays with you for the very fact that it seems as if it's the first time it's ever been done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the quality that has to be there. There's no getting around it on camera. And I just feel that in theatre, people, if I was honest about it, I think they settle for less. I think they settle for less authenticity.
Well, I think one of the things about theatre as opposed to movies is because it is so much more artificial an environment, you know, that the lights aren't necessarily as dark. You can see people moving the theatre sets around. There's no CGI.
Yeah.
You see them sweating. And you know that when people kind of rush off stage left and then kind of pop off stage right, you can see the chest heaving as they kind of gasp for air. And it really forces you to suspend all disbelief.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, okay, I'm just going to live in this magical fantasy, imaginary moment. And then you forgive everybody there. They're allowed to do it too. You know, I think it's a more forgiving medium, actually.
I definitely think I agree with you. I think it is too often seen as a more forgiving medium, which is the same, I guess, is going back to what I said before, which is I think people go in and are prepared to accept less authenticity in respect to the quality of the acting. So I agree with you completely that the suspension of disbelief is entirely different to film, given what theatre is able to do and what it's meant to do.
Special effects in films.
Yeah.
I can remember just... This is apropos of nothing, so this probably won't make it into the final podcast because I'm going off piste here.
That's off piste.
When I took my middle son to go see The Snowman, which is that kiddie thing with walking on the air.
Raymond Briggs, yes. Yeah. Oh, I know.
And he was a little itty-bitty fella. And at a certain point, they go flying through the air. Hmm. And they hook the kid up, and Santa, up with a harness, and they hook him and they yank him up in the air. And my son turned to me and completely straight-faced said, "Don't worry, Mom. If the magic fails, they've got a harness on and a wire." And he was quite comfortable inhabiting two realities. The magic that the snowman had put on the little boy. And then, you know, the safety net was that harness and the wire.
Yeah.
And that kind of both the ability to suspend disbelief while being aware that that's what you're doing, is suspending disbelief.
Yeah.
But if you were to go into a movie and see a wire and a harness when people go flying through the air, you'd be mightily annoyed. You think, God, that's pretty crap.
I think that's right, which is why kids understand that their imagination is being hardwired into the theatrical experience. I'm sure they wouldn't put it quite that way, but nonetheless.
Sure, every seven-year-old thinks
that. I've got a few six-year-olds who mentioned it. But that's what it is, and that's exciting because, of course, it's exciting to have your imagination involved in that way, and it just be an instinctive thing for kids because they're just playful by their very nature. They see a bunch of adults or kids playing on stage, and they get it quicker than an adult would.
Yeah.
I think so for me, because...
Which is why you can also go into kids' theatre and see puppets. So, you know, you got hand in a puppet.
Oh, yeah.
I took my kids to another one. We saw kind of classic fairy tales told with hand puppets.
Mm.
And it was like the Three Billy Groats Gruff. Mm. And they were, again, absolutely wrapped. And you can see the man there with his hand in a sock.
Yeah.
And they were just delighted.
I love puppetry, which might have something to do with an unrequited love I had back at the Central School of Speech and Drama when I was training, and she was a puppeteer. But even before her...
At least she wasn't wooden.
She most definitely wasn't that. And she was a brilliant puppeteer.
She'd already given you a... Never mind.
No, there are all sorts of ways that you could... All sorts of directions you can go, and pulling strings and everything else. But... yeah, she was a brilliant puppeteer, and I understood the art form actually through stop animation film, which is something I was interested in even as a kid, and did a little bit as well. And it's all connected, and so I love all of that kind of stuff as well. But when it comes to acting, specifically acting, the actors on stage, that's where, for me, sometimes theatre can be disappointing. Not always, by any far stretch of the imagination, but I can see the difference.
Mm.
I can see the difference, especially with something like Shakespeare, where you have two actors who are, in the moment, spontaneous, working with each other, rather than just going, "I know that virtue to be new Brutus, as well as I don't know your outward favour. Well, honour is the subject of my story." And they're more interested in the sound of their own voice than they are in doing anything real.
So, Phil, you know, you've made this transition, which... eludes many of us in the creative industry, from being a creative individual to running a business. Was it a big transition for you?
It is still a very big transition for me.
What was the biggest, you know, because this podcast is for creative professionals, so you're, you know, you're here you are, you're a professional actor, you're set up a school, Screen Actors London. What was the biggest challenge you found setting up a business?
Where we started, we failed, we started, we failed, I tried different things.
Well, this is like the beginning of a conversation of being an actor.
It's like anything, there's no easy fix to, you know, being a success at anything, whatever it is, I guess one does, and this is, as I say, hitting me more later on in life, but, you know, I'm a late developer.
You're a late bloomer.
I'm definitely
you?
A late bloomer, my God, I am. So if only my dad was here so I could explain that to him. But I am, and the thing is, you just, it's just tenacity. It's tenacity and passion. And look, if you're passionate about something, ultimately you'd rather be making money at it. You'd rather be able to pay your mortgage. You'd rather be able to put food on the table. And you've got to do these things. Yeah. But it seems silly to be living any kind of life where you're doing a job just to earn money. I can't, that, to me, has never seemed a life worth living. And that might sound little kind of, you know.
Well, we live in a time of peace and prosperity. If there's any time
apparently.
To, yeah, according to the OECD and the Economist. But, you know, if there's any time to take a chance and to try and eke out an existence at the margins, now is the time to do it.
Yeah, and we can do it. I mean, you know what?
We're not living in Syria, for instance, or war, or, you know.
Never was it more obvious. And
how lucky we are.
Lucky we are. But then, you know, life is clearly a relative experience on the basis of what we're talking about just there. And it's very important to get one's head around that. And it's taken me a long time to get my head around
it. So what was the single biggest thing you had to get around? Besides the fact that you have to repeatedly fail.
Me.
You were the single.
I was most definitely the single biggest thing.
You were the
thing
single
that
biggest obstacle to your own success?
I've always been the single biggest obstacle to my success.
In what sense, Phil?
Just getting over myself. I think it's very much an ego thing as much. And it's, you know, one's got to be sort of forgiving as well. But I think a lot of people, a lot of successful people, when they realize that failure is essential to success, that is the same thing as saying, you know what, I'm not such a big deal and it's okay. In fact, it's better that way. Mm. Because the more you think, I think, the more you think, I think, the more we think about ourselves doing this and having to do this and being ambitious. I mean, all of this is important if it comes from passion and it comes from a good place. But if that's all it comes down to, then you're kind of chasing your tail. So, you know, you are the obstacle to your own success because your expectations can never be met, or your parents' expectations can never be met, more likely than not. That's what it comes down to.
Do you think your parents' expectations have been met?
Oh God, no! They're impossible to me. This is where maybe Freud or Jung or one of those guys, they know, Klein, whoever.
So, Phil, just before we go on to our next, because you know you're such an interesting man, because you've, so in addition to that, you've also directed. You've won an award at the Edinburgh Film Festival for your directing.
Well, Edinburgh, and now this is the weird thing. So, I found myself accidentally falling into theatre.
Having just said how much you prefer film.
And
you better not share this podcast with the people who hired you to do the theatre work.
No, I better not. So the strangeness of it is somebody I met on a philosophy course, a brilliant writer called Sophia Mertens. She randomly called me out of the blue. This was a philosophy course we did about, I don't know, we found ourselves doing 10 years ago, and it turned into a cult, but that's a different story. She called
me
up. But probably quite a good story for another time.
Another time. We'll have to have it back for the program to hear how you fell into a philosophy cult.
That's right. Cult cast or something. But yeah. So Sophia got in touch with me. She'd written a play. She got very frustrated, I think, with getting some of her plays done and produced in the way that she wanted to do them. She was both producer and actor. And it was a two-hander. She'd booked the venue up in Edinburgh and just phoned me out of the blue after about at least 8-9 years. And she'd remembered that I directed some sort of thing to do with this philosophy course stroke cult about Plato's Cave. It was like some kind of thing that we did. And so
of
on
course.
That. Of course.
Plato's Cave, yes.
Cave.
I could have predicted that one if I thought about it for a second longer.
It was a fantastic 1-hour play, and it gave me an opportunity to kind of scratch and itch that I have about theatre in a small space, which is very often you go to a fringe theatre and it's a small pub function room or something like that, or a small theatre within a pub. And, you know, it can be very well rehearsed and very slick, but you have a whole bunch of actors who are banging out this play as if they're on the Olivier stage. They haven't quite understood that they
can... The Olivier stage at the South Bank Theatre.
The National, absolutely, yeah.
So a huge stage.
A huge stage. They forget that in actual fact you want to bring an audience in rather than bang out something to them as if you're trying to grab their attention. And of course, bringing an audience into what you're doing is what seems to me any decent theatre play should be about. And in a small venue, in a, I don't know, 80, 90 seater, 120 seater venue, you can talk as we're talking here and you'll be heard.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in actual fact, you very often get, if I just put on a little bit of, use my diaphragm here and start talking to you with a little bit more energy and a little bit more so that people can hear me in the back row. Well, no, you don't need to do that in a small venue, which means there are all sorts of nuances and subtleties that you can get, a real level of authenticity you can get into a small production. So it was an opportunity for me to do that. And we got 5-star reviews up in Edinburgh. We could have done with better audiences, but that wasn't the important thing because the people who came to see it were blown away by it. And that was a shock to me as much as anybody else. But it was nice to know that, you know, after all my self-criticism, that's something I did get right. That's something I feel that I succeeded in. But most definitely with Eddie and Sophia, my partners in crime in that production, and Chris, this amazing lighting designer who taught me so much about lighting, things that I didn't know anything about. And I was familiar with lighting from a film point of view, but not from a theatre point of view. And it was hugely exciting working with Sophia, Eddie and Chris to collaboratively work on something that people really enjoyed.
Would you ever do it again?
I'd love to do it again. In fact, I turned up to my friend Sophia's birthday just the other day, and very kindly, she wants me to bring me back for another play that hopefully we'll be doing up in Edinburgh next summer. Yeah,
fantastic. I think this is a great moment to take a break to hear a word from our sponsors. We'll be back with you in a moment.
Okay.
In 2015, Katie Asbesta set up Claret Press. Over the following months, she was so overwhelmed by inquiries from writers for editorial guidance and expertise that she set up Clapham Publishing Services, a business catering to every writing and publishing need. At Clapham Publishing Services, our editors have many years' experience in the publishing industry. We've helped produce a wide range of projects. We've edited everything from fiction to doctoral dissertations, produced copy for blogs and ghostwritten memoirs, and help with the self-publishing of novels, art books, cookbooks, and non-fiction. Writers who send their work to us know that they're getting experienced and knowledgeable feedback, appropriate for the stage they're working at. All our clients receive the support of a team who are aiming for the same goal as the author. Whatever you're working on, we can tailor our service to you. Get in touch with us today by emailing contact@claphampublishing.com or visit our website, claphampublishing.com.
Welcome back to Claret in Conversation. Our guest today is Phil Wolf, the actor, director, the screen actor coach here in Screen Actors London, and he's also a writer. And I have a personal interest in this, being a publisher. Tell me a bit. I know that one of your movies has been optioned, which is pretty exciting, and hopefully it will find a producer and we'll see it on the big screen. I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, so a producer optioned it. It's been an interesting experience, I'll say delicately, both good and bad, if I was absolutely honest. But as I say, that in itself has been a learning experience for somebody who's come to writing, screenplay writing in my case, late on in life.
Oh, well, that's okay. A lot of the best writers also start late in life. So that doesn't, I don't see that as a drawback. And plus, with all due respect, Phil, you're not really quite as long in the tooth as you claim you are.
Oh, you're very kind, yeah, Katie, you're very kind. It's the light.
It's the lighting, is it? You're writing something now. Do you want to tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. So, well, I suppose it's along the same genre of the feature that I had optioned, which is a supernatural thriller. And I grew up with having a great interest in, I suppose, horror movies, for want of a better way of explaining them. But I was much more interested in the sort of the psychological horror movies. So movies like you wouldn't maybe even see them as horror movies. Picnic at Hanging Rock, Don't Look Now, then maybe moving on to others which are considered more
Parasite is probably the movie of the moment that everybody's calling a psychological thriller slash horror movie.
So I understand it, and having watched the Oscars, I'm ashamed to say I haven't quite seen it yet, but I'm so close to seeing it I can't even begin to tell you I'm very excited to see it.
But you would say that would be the genre that you quite that you're not really that you enjoy, but you quite that you're writing.
Yes, I think growing up I used to read a lot of supernatural fiction, and so moving away, I suppose, from the feature, which again is influenced by the films that I love, Picnic, Hanging Rock, Angel Heart, The Shining, these kind of films, and what I'm working on at the moment is serialized drama. I think it could easily go into at least two or three or four seasons, a Netflixy type of
thinking big. Wait, we're talking about here Black Mirror.
It's definitely more Black Mirror. Again, from what I've seen of it, I think a sort of very much sort of self-contained works, rather than a more connected narrative all the way through, and that's what I'm looking at. So, to explain myself better, it's probably easier to talk about the writer whose work I'm adapting, which is
adapting a writer.
I'm adapting the work of H.P. Lovecraft,
the science fiction writer.
The supernatural science fiction. So people always actually struggle, and I struggle with trying to figure out what genre he falls into.
Which box should we put him into?
I think more recently, cosmic horror is the rather grandiose, title that's been attributed.
Cosmic horror. Do you know, I've never heard that before. Mm. Cosmic horror, sci-fi horror.
Yeah, he definitely was a supernatural fiction writer who, as you rightly say, brought in science, because when he was writing in the 20s, 30s, he died in 1937. He was considered at the time a pulp writer. He wasn't even published in his lifetime, other than in a magazine called Weird Fiction, which was essentially a pulpy, it wasn't considered high literature by any far stretch of the imagination. But although H.P. Lovecraft is very well known amongst certain people, and a lot of people, in some sense he's not a household name, although were you to ask Stephen King who his greatest influence was as a writer, he'd probably go for H.P. Lovecraft above and beyond anybody else's, I understand it.
So, I mean, science fiction right now is kind of hot, hot, hot.
Mm.
You know, and Philip K. Dick is endlessly mined for new movie ideas because of the... And he was basically unread. And I have tried. I want to put my hand up and confess that I'm one of the people who have tried to read Philip K. Dick and just saw a bad need of a good editor to kind of hammer that into a story. But nonetheless, these fabulous ideas coming out of these very creative, lateral thinking minds that are just engaging with reality in a very different way from the rest of us.
That's exactly right. And I think it's their ideas and their imagination that are the most interesting thing about them. Very often, stylistically, these writers are not everybody's cup of tea because they're kind of unreadable. H.P. Lovecraft is a classic case in point because he's parodied left, right, and center for his verbose, flowery, adjectival sentences that end endlessly. They never end. They never end.
Yeah.
I mean, he is the classic example of it. And yet, to be fair to him, that's very much a part of who he was as a writer. And if you can see beyond that and look at the extraordinary, limitless imagination that he had, then he's a fantastically exciting writer to read. However,
and a better writer to adapt.
Better
to adapt than to read them.
Yeah. Exactly. No, exactly right. I mean, to work on a contemporary adaptation of what he's writing, if I can find a way around that, and I'm having a great time doing it at the moment. It's a great way to approach his ideas as a person. I have to say, H.P. Lovecraft was most definitely a very, how can I put it, Well, to put it delicately, he very complex and had some very unlikable, extremely unlikable ideas and beliefs.
Like what?
I'm afraid to say he was not a big fan of immigration.
Well, look, our entire ruling elite at this moment is not a big fan of immigration. You know, that would take out anybody who's educated at Eton.
Yeah, and I think, he was an American writer, as I say, writing in the 20s and 30s, working in Providence, Rhode Island, and he saw himself as an Anglophile and a gentleman. In truth, he had all sorts of skeletons in the closet, and although his family... one generation away were very wealthy. He essentially was not at all wealthy himself. All the family money disappeared over a period of time, and he was left.
Did he blame immigrants for that?
Oh, he blamed everybody, and I think he hated everybody, but probably hated himself more than anybody else. You look at his work, and I'm sad to say that racism and anti-Semitism is clearly there in a lot of the short stories he's writing. And for somebody such as myself and my father,
you've got Jewish.
Well, so this is the oddness of it. Being very interested in H.P. Lovecraft's work for all sorts of reasons might seem something of a contradiction, because my father was a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust over in Germany. He was on the Kinder transport and came
Good
over
Lord.
Here. And my grandfather was murdered in Auschwitz.
Good Lord, Phil.
So you wouldn't really, given my family history, and I know very clearly what it did to my dad, and my dad was a remarkable man who was able to salvage a life, more than salvage a life, have a very successful life and give me all sorts of things that very few people would have growing up.
He was one of the lucky few.
He was one of the lucky few.
Here you are.
And here I am writing
this very problematic individuals. Mm. But you know, this puts so many of us in a tricky situation. You know, like we went recently, my husband and I, down to one of these kind of piles of rubble that dots the English countryside, the country home of Eric Gill, who was a sculptor and a designer, and he came up with a typeface called Gill.
Oh, yeah.
And he was also very publicly abusing his own daughters. He did the typeface for the British Library, for instance. When you walk into the British Library, there's this beautiful carved stone gate that you go through that was based on his typeface. Mm. And, one of the things I find astonishing is how... You know, he not merely drew pictures of his daughters naked. Mm. He kept diaries, and it was pretty much public. And he kind of said, well, you know, I'm experimenting with my sexuality.
Oh, yeah.
And, you go down, I'm thinking, I paid money to go into a museum dedicated to a man who was a pedophile. And to look at what his and his friends, who were at least complicit with that, who were also great artists... And it's extremely uncomfortable.
Well, we're living in a time, fortunately, now that where you know, at least on the surface of things, none of this is tolerated. Whereas before, even going back to the 80s, you know, back to the old Jim'll Fix It days, all of these things were tolerated. Sure. It's going to take time, I think, for perhaps, hopefully, for everybody to get on the right page with all of this, and that it won't just be a bunch of people talking about changing things, but actually changing them. But at least the conversation is there.
Yes.
And this clearly is true across the board, you know, whether it, in terms of race, gender and everything else. And it raises this question of, you know, you never want to meet your heroes or heroines, clearly, because if you do, they're always going to be disappointing. But this is a separate thing. So I guess one has to separate a person from what they do up to a point. In relation to H.P. Lovecraft, I don't need to, fortunately, because part of the reason that he is a horror writer, through want of a better way of describing him, the reason that he's influenced so many other writers after him is because he's the living embodiment of what it is to live a rather wretched life, to live through the fears and the horrors that he's brought upon himself because of the attitude that he has of others, the fear of other people. Mm-hmm. Nothing is more terrifying. And the truth of it is, it seems to me that everybody... without wanting to sort of state the obvious, is afraid of other people at some level.
Mm-hmm.
There's a level of discomfort that everybody has with somebody who isn't them. Mm. Half the time, they're just as afraid of themselves as they are of anybody else, without getting too philosophical about it. Nonetheless, you know, that idea that everybody's a little bit racist, well, duh, of course they are. I mean, in as much as that everybody's not quite trusting of somebody who comes from a background that is different to theirs. The more they find out, the more they learn. And again, no big surprise.
Yeah, the distrust, the
more tolerant they become, because the wiser they become and the more knowledgeable they become. I mean, it's the fear of others and the fear of the unknown. And with H.P. Lovecraft, it's as obvious in respect of his characters and their relationship to the world in which they find themselves. So it's a fantastic thing, especially now with nationalism on the rise, populism, yes, all of these things, mm-hmm, which are essentially borderline fascist qualities, or not even borderline, all about...
Yeah, it's pretty overt at the moment, as far as I'm concerned.
It's pretty overt. It's the usual cyclical thing of the same thing that tore my dad away from his family, mm-hmm, and brought him here to the UK. It's happening again, and it's always happened, and it will happen, no doubt, again, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing to mention is it's happening right now in an insidious, unconscious, and sometimes not so unconscious way. The same fears, the same insecurities, and the environment's very much a part of that as well. So it's all tied in, I think. And
yes,
all of these things are ideas that H.P. Lovecraft was writing about. He was on the wrong side of
the equation.
The equation, but he had a nuts and bolts experience of it. And so to contemporize his work, if I can, and bring out some of these issues, but also to use and find a way of taking the extraordinary imagination that H.P. Lovecraft had,
mm-hmm,
translating that, mm-hmm, to a contemporary setting is what I'm looking to try and do with what
sounds
I'm
like writing. It does sound really, really provocative,
mm,
and a little bit scary.
Hope so.
And very interesting.
Yeah, I hope so.
Can I ask, what do you think your father would make of this? Well, about you adapting H.P. Lovecraft for today's environment? Would he be cool with it?
Yeah, I think he'd be really interested. He was fascinated. He was fascinated with Hitler. He'd seen Hitler in a truck driving through Nordhausen, his family home. So he was aware of the anti-Semitism kicking off before he left.
Mm-hmm.
But he was fascinated by Hitler, fascinated by Napoleon, mm-hmm, and perhaps for reasons that are self-evident, because he spent his whole life trying to come to terms with how a civilized country, as he saw it, no different to the one that apparently we're living through at the moment in our country, could turn.
Mm-hmm.
And it can. And it did.
Yes, yes.
And it did for real. It wasn't just a history book thing for my dad. It was, I remember him saying at one point, or implying that it was while, you know, David Cameron was our prime minister, it's no different. For me, it was like David Cameron suddenly turning around and going, you know what, it's time to close all the Jewish shops.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get some of these guys into prisons and have them working for us. And
so he takes it back to David Cameron as early as that.
No, I mean, to be fair to David Cameron, if one can be, then he wasn't, you know, sort of making a direct sort of.
But he saw with that kind of that right wing, you know, that language that was emerging. Admittedly, it was during the time of David Cameron. You had the rise of Nigel Farage. You had the rise of that hard right anti-immigration. And certainly under David Cameron, he pushed the Conservative Party from centre-right to hard-right in an effort to forestall the rise of UKIP.
Yes, which, again, I mean, again, I don't want to become an apologist for David Cameron. That's the last thing.
Given that
he's clearly responsible for one of the most disastrous mistakes that any politician has made this century, as far as I can tell. But I think it was a mistake, and I think that he was doing certain things that for a Conservative Prime Minister, weirdly enough, were surprisingly, you know, representative at times. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think
it seemed like a reasonable response.
Well, yes. I mean, I think whether he put his career on the line for gay marriage, but he certainly was out there being supportive of it at the very least, mm-hmm. You know, to give him some,
yeah, some credit where it's
some small credit. Yeah. But no, given that by accident, perhaps, we found ourselves in a situation which has clearly radicalized the most unsavory, political elements in our society. Is a horrible situation to find ourselves in, but again, it's these patterns are very, very clearly repeatable,
mm-hmm.
And there are clear connections to be made with what my dad went through. They stumbled accidentally into a situation that became further and further right wing, intolerant, isolationist, separatist. You know, and that's I'm very glad my dad isn't around here to see that. Now, as I say, given that he was trying to come to terms with these things throughout his whole life, fascinated because he had to be. But I mean, even in his dying days, he was seeing Nazis under the bed and all of this sort of thing. And that's made me very, very aware of the fact that,
well,
you
maybe
know,
you are
trauma.
The right guy to update H.P. Lovecraft then. You know, maybe you are the right guy to be moving him into the 21st century and showing us kind of the horrors of our own of our own reality.
In a medium that I find interesting and exciting and expressive, if I can do it, I'll be very, very happy. But I've got a lot to learn. So,
This is your modesty, Phil. You know, you've written something that's already been optioned. I find it quite interesting that the most successful people are the most humble and modest. You know, they go, oh, you know, I have nothing but fail, fail, fail. You know, and you set up a successful school and you get moved that are optioned and you're at the Edinburgh Fringe and you've won awards for your acting. You go, yes, but I just failed. I failed. I did nothing but fail.
It's true. Well, it's true. I mean, it's true. I mean, as I say, meeting the expectations of our parents is an impossible thing, and this is true, no doubt, you know, endlessly throughout all civilizations.
Well, what would be your greatest gift then to the credit? Because I asked all my guests two questions: what most influenced them and made them want to be creative? And I think you've already answered that by saying film.
Yeah.
And would you say of all these areas that you have kind of, this is not your perception; it's my perception of you. All these areas in which you've kind of super achieved at coaching, acting, directing, writing, which one do you think is your greatest contribution to the creative arts?
Honestly,
maybe you haven't peaked yet.
I most definitely have not peaked yet, Katie.
Because you're a late bloomer. I think I've already agreed.
I am a late bloomer. My history will tell. Time will tell.
But you know what, Phil?
What my contribution, if anything, will ever be.
I think we have to get you back when the H.P. Lovecraft Netflix miniseries gets optioned, and we'll have another conversation, and maybe then you'll know what's been your greatest contribution. In the meantime, good luck with your Stagecoach London.
Oh, Screen Actors London, yes.
Beg your pardon, Screen Actors London.
Maybe Stagecoach London could come next.
And your acting, and good luck with getting this writing. I hope it really works out for you.
Thank you for having me on your show. It's been fantastic.
It's been interesting certainly for me, I hope.
Very much for me too.
Next week, our guest will be Eugene Skief, the musician, composer, poet, and activist. So pour yourself a glass of claret and join our conversation. Claret and Conversation is available on all major platforms. If you like this podcast and would like to hear more about professionals in the creative industry, please subscribe, comment, and share. We'd love to hear from you. For the occasional update and other news, please like us on Twitter or like the Facebook page for Claret Press or Clapham Publishing Services, or subscribe to either website.